This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The nine members of the U.S. Supreme Court are part of the most exclusive and powerful club in the world. There was once much more mystery about who they are and how they do what they do. But in this age of media scrutiny and loosening of old traditions, we seem to know more than ever about the people behind these important decisions. A lot of questions remain, though, about the short and long-term impact of their decisions, especially during a term that features as many big legal decisions as this year's. Today, Where We Live, judging the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll talk to legal experts and journalists and learn more about the court's role in American democracy, both now and in the future. We'll try to answer questions like, is the court getting more liberal? And what's the value of a dissenting opinion? We'll also preview an upcoming forum on the court in Washington, Connecticut. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in studio today is Renee Falco. She's Associate Professor and Director of the Public Policy and Law Program at Trinity College. Renee, it's great to see you as always. Thanks for coming back to Where We Live.
Oh, my pleasure, John.
Joining us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. is Joan Biskupic, who's Editor-in-Charge for Legal Affairs at Reuters News, author of several books, including Breaking In, The Rise of Sonia Sotomayor and The Politics of Justice. Joan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John.
And Jeffrey Toobin joins us by phone. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and a senior analyst for CNN. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeff.
Morning, John.
Jeff and Joan will be participating in a conversation called Verdict on the Nine, How to Judge the Supreme Court, which will be taking place on August 9th at St. John's Church Parish Hall in Washington, Connecticut. We'll have more information on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. We'll start big with you, Jeff, and just ask the question, how do you judge the Supreme Court?
Well, you judge them by their results. They have the last word on what's constitutional, what's legal, what can be tolerated in the United States. And I think the only way to judge what they do is to judge what they do. And this past term was an enormously important one. And the country is different. For better or worse, for the decisions they made.
The country is different for the decisions that they make, but the country, Jeff, as many people note, is a much different place than when many of the justices took the seat on the Supreme Court. How much of an impact do you think that that has on the work that they do, the fact that clearly America has moved in some very different directions politically, socially, over the course of the last few decades?
Well, but if you look at the makeup of the Supreme Court, to me, the most important thing is not gender, it's not race, it's not religion, it's political affiliation. And there are five Republicans on the court and four Democrats on the court. And frankly, that's most of what you need to know about the Supreme Court. It is closely divided, very much along political lines, and so is the country. So I think the Supreme Court is actually a pretty good mirror for, imperfect, not exactly like the country, but pretty darn close. And I think that's the way it was set up politically, that you have the president nominating people, the Senate confirming or not confirming them. And they are all politicians. The people involved in the nomination and confirmation process. So there is a definite political cast to the court, and I don't say that as criticism. I just think that's the way it's inevitably going to be.
So Jeff Toobin says you judge the court by its results, and we're going to talk more, I think, Joan, about political affiliation and how that affects what they do. But how about you? When somebody asks you to judge the U.S. Supreme Court, Joan, what do you say?
I would agree with much of what Jeffrey said, but I would add this caveat. You have to understand that each term brings different cases and different challengers, and sometimes you have to weigh that into the mix. I do not agree with some commentators who believe that the court has suddenly turned liberal. I think that there's the same-sex marriage decision was quite momentous, but it was a single type of challenge that doesn't stand for the whole. And I think similarly with the Supreme Court's upholding of the Obama health care plan, a lot of people read that as a turn to the left, but I think that was a very straightforward ruling in interpretation of statutory construction. And I think there it's a measure of the challengers and how strongly they wanted to get rid of the health care plan that was passed by a very divided Congress back in 2010. So I think you judge them by their rulings, but know that each term brings different kinds of cases. Next term, for example, I think we'll have many more cases that are much more litmus tests of the kind of political polarization that Jeff referred to. You know, the court wasn't always like this, divided neatly by political affiliation. It changed essentially in 2010 when Elena Kagan succeeded John Paul Stevens. John Paul Stevens turned out to be a liberal, but he had been appointed in 1975 by Republican President Gerald Ford. And now what we have is essentially just a completely split 5-4 group of nine who are divided by political affiliation in ways that previous courts were not.
Rennie, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I actually was thinking some of the same things. And I guess I wonder what both of our guests would say about that. I mean, is part of the problem here, you know, that the country, you know, as Jeffrey said, is so polarized. The court mirrors that. But it also seems to me that the polarization means that some of the disputes that might otherwise get resolved in Congress, for example, don't get resolved. And so they end up in court. And I think Joan referred to the fact that the healthcare case was really, many people thought, kind of an odd case to be bringing, but the opponents brought it. And in another time, some of the problems with the healthcare bill might have been resolved in Congress rather than in the court. And I just wonder if our guest might speak to that.
Well, Jeff, I'll let you weigh in first. This idea that Congress really should be handling many of these issues that rise to the court, and because they seem incapable of solving America's big problems, now these cases end up in a place that maybe shouldn't be judging whether or not we have an Affordable Care Act structure the way we do.
Well, I think there is something to that. Congress is not just polarized, but it seems largely paralyzed to pass actual legislation. But you know, I don't think there was a period in the past where the Supreme Court was a perfectly apolitical institution. It's always been deeply political. And in just regarding the current makeup of the court, again, I think it reflects the country. If you look at three justices who've left recently, David Souter, John Paul Stevens, Sandra Day O'Connor, they were all to varying degrees moderate Republicans. And moderate Republicans have disappeared from America, not just the Supreme Court. They're no more in the Senate. They're no more in the House of Representatives. So it's not surprising that they're no more on the Supreme Court either. So again, I don't think the Supreme Court is any sort of aberration to what's going on politically in the country. I think it's a pretty good reflection.
Joan?
I would just say there might be one lingering moderate Republican, Jeff, and that would be Anthony Kennedy, who certainly holds the key to this court just because his vote is so valuable between the two factions. And indeed, he obviously was the man who delivered the Declaration of a Right to Same-Sex Marriage. And he also joined this time in the health care ruling favoring Obamacare. He also was critical in a case that was a bit surprising given where this court has been on race. He handed a victory to civil rights groups in the administration when he provided the fifth vote in a ruling involving the Fair Housing Act that many people thought the justices might be ready to curtail the scope of that law. And Kennedy, again, a little bit more moderate there, stopped that. And I think it reflected, frankly, where all lower courts had been and probably where more sentiment in the country is.
But then, Joan, how should we as a country then read these decisions if indeed the political makeup of the court reflects the political polarization of America, and you have on almost every major case four staunch Republicans and four staunch Democrats, or conservatives and liberals, if you want to use those terms, and one key vote in the middle that is almost always going to swing one way or the other and be so incredibly important. I guess I'm asking, what does that say about the current makeup of the court if so much power is held by one person because of the polarization on the other ends?
But it has always been that way. You figure since 1789, the individuals on the Supreme Court have been appointed as part of a political process. They are named for life, of course, and Chief Justice John Roberts would be the first to say that he believes they're more neutral, they have more integrity than other politicians. In fact, at one point this term, in a test of judicial spending in state elections for judges, he said, judges are not politicians. And he, in that case, actually swung over with the liberals to uphold a campaign finance law down in Florida. But this is how it's been. And Jeff referred to Sandra Day O'Connor, who was often the justice in the middle during her nearly 25-year tenure. But before that, it was Lewis Powell. This is something that isn't born of where we're at today in 2015. It's been out there for a long time. And I think that overall, we'd like to have a more romantic notion of the court as being above the fray, but it's part of the fray. I think that's the best way for people to understand the Supreme Court.
Rennie, I'd love for you to comment on something that Jeff said earlier when he was talking about the makeup of the court being largely based on these political lines, Democrats and Republicans, and that being more important, say, than gender. We have three women on the court right now, and depending on who you read, there is an importance or not about their gender, about what cases are important to them or how they might rule as women as opposed to, you know, largely older white men that come from a different era. Do you think the gender makeup on the court right now plays a larger role than maybe some suggest?
I think it's a little early to tell, but I think it does make a difference. I don't know that I can give a concrete example that would absolutely prove your point. But I think having women on the court who are attuned to issues perhaps in a different way, I think over time has to make a difference. And I think that there has been evidence sometimes in oral arguments in terms of the kinds of questions that the women might ask that might be somewhat different from what the men would ask and also might bring different issues to the forefront. It's also true that the women on the court, these women, are on the more liberal side. So, you know, it's hard for me to tease apart what is a result of what their, you know, what their approach to the law might be because they're on the more liberal end and how much that has to do with just being women.
Jeff Toobin, do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I think it's important that there are three women on the court for symbolic reasons and just for reasons that indicate how the country is changing. I mean, Joan knows, as someone who has covered the court closely for many years, you walk into that courtroom and you see three women on the bench who are very active questioners, and that is a very different picture of the Supreme Court, certainly than when I started covering it in the mid-1980s. However, when it comes to voting, it is much more important that they are Democratic appointees than that they are women. If George W. Bush had appointed, say, Edith Jones, a very conservative judge on the Fifth Circuit, to the Supreme Court, she would have voted in a very different way than the other three women who are currently on the court. So, you know, I think politics in terms of voting very much trumps gender, but that does not mean that gender is unimportant.
Joan, did you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, I'd like to mention a couple things about the differences among these three women. First of all, we have the age difference. We have Justice Ginsburg at 82, down to Justice Kagan at 55. So their experiences as women and pioneers in their fields are very different. Justice Ginsburg, you know, was right out there with the women's rights movement, and Justice Kagan would be the first to acknowledge that she was a beneficiary of what Justice Ginsburg had done. And they are all three Democrats, but they're not of the same liberal stripe. Just here's one example, for instance, Justice Ginsburg joined with Justice Breyer to protest completely the idea of accepting where we're at with cruel and unusual punishment for lethal injection. They both suggested in a dissent that on the last day of the term that the court should look seriously at whether the death penalty as it stands in America violates the Eighth Amendment. Now, Justice Kagan did not join that. Justice Sotomayor wrote something that wasn't quite that far, but she was a little closer to it. But Justice Kagan, obviously made a choice not to join that statement by Justice Breyer. The one area where all three are consistently together would be on reproductive rights, especially as it's come up in challenges to the contraceptive mandate in the Obama health care law.
I'm wondering, before we have to take a break, Joan, if maybe you could talk about some of the cases that perhaps run against this prevailing thought that the court is getting more liberal because of these very high-profile cases having to do with the Affordable Care Act and having to do with same-sex marriage.
Well, I'll start where I just left off with Glossop versus Gross. That's the Oklahoma death penalty case that was decided on the last day of the term that prompted, Jeff, I wish you had been in the courtroom. You would have loved this. Four different readings from the bench and Scalia dissenting from a dissent. It was high drama there. And just so your listeners know, the justices decided that the sedative drug used in Oklahoma's lethal injection process does not violate the U.S. Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. 5-4 split, again, along our familiar ideological and political lines. Dissenting were Justices Breyer, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. And what that case prompted was a pretty heated discussion, not just on lethal injection, but about the state of the death penalty in America. So that was one ruling that certainly cuts the other way. And then also in the environmental protection area, the justices ruled, 5-4 in a case known as Michigan versus Environmental Protection Agency, that the Obama administration should have considered costs when it issued key environmental regulation to limit emissions of mercury and other hazardous pollutants from coal-fired power plants. So you're gonna still see that, but I think you have to judge the court term by term and sort of probe down into the kinds of cases before it.
Yeah, Jeff, I have a question for you. What do you think were the biggest surprises of this term? I think probably our audience would be interested in that.
The truly overwhelming nature of the Obama administration's victory in King versus Burwell, the healthcare case. I think most of us who covered the court, and Joan can disagree, probably thought the odds slightly favored the Obama administration winning that case. That case, in an absolutely brilliant and totally eviscerating opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, just threw that case out with the morning trash, and Justice Kennedy joined that opinion. I guess the utterly convincing nature of that decision, and really the repudiation of the legal strategy, which was essentially a kind of gamesmanship to go around the political process and gut the law judicially rather than politically. And I guess to me, that case, because it was just so enormously significant, more than 6 million people kept their health insurance subsidies, the law avoided going into a death spiral. That case to me, I think, not necessarily in the result, but just sort of how the result was expressed, what was to me the biggest surprise of the term.
Jeffrey Toobin is staff writer for The New Yorker and a senior analyst for CNN, along with Joan Biskupic. He'll be participating in a conversation called Verdict on the Nine, How to Judge the Supreme Court. It's coming up on August 9th in Washington, Connecticut. More information on our website, WNPR.org/where we live. Jeffrey Toobin, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll continue with Joan and also with Rennie Falco from Trinity College as we analyze the Supreme Court, a very important term. We'll also ask some questions about members of the court, their interpersonal relationships, and also what's the value of a dissent. You can join us at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, we're taking a look at the U.S. Supreme Court after a very, very important, a monumental term. We're trying to get a verdict on the nine. That's the subject of an upcoming event in Washington, Connecticut that we'll be talking more about. One of the panelists there is Joan Biskupic, who's editor in charge for legal affairs at Reuters News and the author of several books, including Breaking In, The Rise of Sonia Sotomayor, and The Politics of Justice. She joins us today from Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C. Joining us in our studio here in Hartford is Rennie Falco, who's associate professor and director of the Public Policy and Law Program at Trinity College. We'll take some of your calls and questions at 860-275-7266. If you've got questions about the U.S. Supreme Court or any cases that came up during this most recent term, one of the things that we're always interested in is the dissents to the majority opinion. Some of the most colorful dissents are written by Antonin Scalia. John Stewart, of course, took a look at some of the words that he used and poked a little bit of fun.
Jiggery pokery, applesauce, sir! Let us not say things we can never take back. Or even understand.
Of course, Stewart, they're making fun of some of the language that Antonin Scalia uses when he goes off on a long dissent. There's a lot of questions about this, Joan, but first I guess I'll just ask, what is the value of a dissenting opinion? Many people who don't follow the court on a daily basis, many Americans say, well, it's 5-4 or it's 9-0, and the score is what matters. Now we've got law, but the dissent is sometimes a very, very important piece of work. What do you see as the value?
Well, I see it on two levels, John. The first is it's a way to say, look at me, pay attention. I want people to see where the majority went wrong. But mainly, I want to get your attention for a moment. And when the justices write a dissent, they sometimes at the end of the year will also read parts of their dissent from the bench. And that's another thing that reinforces the idea, pay attention here. Listen to this contrary view. Now, Justice Scalia is excellent at getting people's attention, for better or for worse, with his language. And that favors him in some ways so that people are drawn to his legal rationales. And that helps him, although it can bring lots of mockery because of his language and also because of what he stands for. So you have kind of the theater side there. But then more substantively, it can lay the groundwork for rulings in the future. And I'll point again to the death penalty case where Justices Breyer and Ginsburg said, listen, everyone, we disagree with what the majority has said about Oklahoma's lethal injection, but we also want your attention to question the idea of whether the death penalty as it stands now violates the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. So that's one other way. And I'll just one last thing before sure. I know Rennie will jump in here. Chief Justice John Roberts, for the first time in his 10-year tenure, read excerpts of his dissent from the bench in the same-sex marriage case. And I thought it was a very big moment for him because, first of all, he had not done that before. And also, all eyes were going to be on the Supreme Court for this ruling declaring a right to same-sex marriage in all 50 states. And he used it to say, people of faith can take no comfort in this ruling. You might celebrate people who happen to now be able to get married under the Constitution, but do not celebrate the Constitution because the Constitution was disserved here. So it's a way to, in a very public way, offer contrary views and perhaps to shape public opinion and or shape other cases coming down the road.
Yeah, if I could just follow up, I think I would certainly agree with you. But I know when I teach, as I taught this summer, a group of graduate students, they are taken aback by sometimes the harshness of the dissents. I wonder if you might say something about that. What do we read into that? Don't read into it. It doesn't really mean anything at all. I never know quite what to make of it.
Well, it's the individual individual justices feel they have more leeway to be more negative, contrary, insulting when they're writing a dissent. Often they won't get all the other dissenters to sign their opinion. There are plenty of times when Justice Scalia or Thomas will dissent and their fellow conservative colleagues who happen to be also opposed to the majority view will not sign their dissent because of some harsh language in it. I think that sometimes it can backfire. And I know Dean of the University of California School at Irvine, Law School at Irvine, Erwin Chemerinsky, who you probably know, Rennie, mm-hmm. finds it very off-putting, some of the language that Justice Scalia, for example, will put in his opinions, and thinks that, first of all, it's a very bad model to law students to think that this is the way to engage in a civil substantive conversation about the law, that it's bad on that front, and also that it sort of demeans the office. Now, I have to say, some of the liberals can sometimes have strong language or zingers, but Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg prides herself in not using a lot of zingers like her good friend Antonin Scalia does.
I guess I'm wondering if you just comment, though, then on the thesis that Jeff Toobin put forward to us, that in most ways the court is a political body made up of people who are Republicans and Democrats, and if you extend that, Antonin Scalia and others aren't really necessarily having a legal conversation as much as that might be the thing they should do, but they're having a political conversation. And in the politics of the day, Joan, harsh language, including language that then you can take back as you sit and have a drink with somebody afterward, is a part of the Washington political game today. Is that really the game that they're playing as opposed to a judicial or legal game, as one might think?
Well, this has been going on for a long time when it comes to Justice Scalia. Back when Justice O'Connor was on the court, he wrote that her legal reasoning cannot be taken seriously. He has mocked Justice Kennedy repeatedly. This year, he brought it to perhaps a personal high when he said if he had written what Justice Kennedy wrote in the opening to the same-sex marriage case, he'd have to hide his head in a bag. That became a part of the permanent legal record. I think that really does go to an extent that Justice Scalia had not gone before. So I think his dissents have to be read on many levels. Some of them are, you know, definitely a legal judicial level because he's addressing the reasoning in the majority opinion, but the personal attacks are pretty strong when it comes to him, and almost unique when it comes to him in terms of the very, very tough personal attacks. And Justice Kennedy's sitting there right on the bench with him. But you know what Justice Kennedy has? He has the majority.
Right. Yeah. And I was just going to say one other thing. It seemed to me that in his majority opinion, Kennedy really didn't pay too much attention to it. It's almost like he just ignored it to the degree that he could. So I thought that was also interesting that he didn't actually engage it.
That's right.
It's something us in media learned a long time ago. If you don't engage it, sometimes it will go away. In a moment, we'll get to your phone calls at 860-275-7266. But I want to put that question to David Yeloff, who's a professor and department head in the Department of Political Science at the University of Connecticut. He joins us now by phone. David, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm wondering if you can pick up on that last piece of our conversation about the value of dissent, but also perhaps the value of the majority opinion. I suggested earlier that many lay people who look at the court only as making law for us don't read the words that are written often. I guess I'm wondering how you view the value of the written word, the dissents and the majority opinions that help to shape how the court really feels about something as they rule.
Well, I think Joan had a very nice categorization about the different ways that dissents in particular can either lay groundwork or allow a justice like Scalia to vent. I mean, I really kind of distinguish his types of dissents and the words of those dissents with, you know, some of the great dissents from the early part of the 20th century, whether it was Brandeis or Holmes, sometimes in concurrence, but sometimes in dissent, talking about free speech. And what they were doing was laying the groundwork that other justices later picked up on, and dissents of one era became majority opinions of the other. that's in some ways when Justice Scalia takes a more acerbic tone and you know, gets a little bit personal in some of his language, he's not necessarily doing his side service. He's certainly not laying a great groundwork for future justices to take up on those aspects of his opinions. And so what you've been reading in the last few years is, while excitement on the part of social conservatives that Justice Scalia is so principled, maybe a frustration that he hasn't necessarily played the game or laid the groundwork or engaged in those kind of synergistic intercollegiate discussions that might actually lead to victories instead of just harsh defeats.
Hi, David. It's Rennie. Nice to hear your voice. I would just say one other thing when we talk about dissents. There's a very good example of a case where the Ledbetter case, where Justice Ginsburg had a very civil dissent that also actually had recommendations for Congress, which Congress followed, and we had the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. So I think it's important to note that sometimes dissents really can lead to action.
Well, I think that's a great point, and it's something it's easy to forget. But I also think it is interesting if you go back to when Justice Scalia was first nominated to the court in 1986. There was a lot of discussion within the Reagan administration and excitement that here was a person who wasn't just a great legal mind, but was affable, seemed to get along terrific with the other justices on the D.C. Circuit and other individuals in Washington, and that he might be able to kind of be a Justice Brennan for the conservatives in being able to craft majorities and stitch up varied opinions into majority law. And it did miss the part that even on the D.C. Circuit, then Judge Scalia very often refused to go along with senior colleagues, was very principled, really distinguished personal relationships off the bench with what goes on the bench.
Now, let's go to the phones. David from Woodbury joins us. Hi, David. Go ahead. John, where we live.
Oh, hi, everybody. Hi, John. One thing that was many of us found profoundly troubling was the time, the situation with Bush versus Gore, when, in effect, they appointed the president when the country should have appointed the president. They broke the virtual Florida tie, and I didn't think that was right, and many of us didn't think that was right. Somehow there should have been a revote in Florida, but that gave it to George Bush, of course, and of course that led to the Iraq War, which many of us which was a pure tragedy.
Well, David, let me put that to our legal experts, and thank you so much. Much like a political decision in one's career, Joan, that decision has left a mark on every Supreme Court to come, because this is one time in America where we can say the leader of the United States is actually decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. David in Woodbury and many other millions of Americans still hold that against that court's decision. What should we make of that this many years down the road, 15 years away from that?
Isn't it interesting? We are 15 years away from that decision in Bush v. Gore, but yet it's very much on people's minds. I think the court itself would like to put it behind it. A lot of people forget that Justice O'Connor, who turned out to be quite a moderate in the end, and Justice Kennedy, also moderate now, moderate conservative, both of those voted for the Bush side in that case. Many of the other justices, or some of the other justices, weren't on the court, but Chief Justice John Roberts actually went down to Tallahassee, Florida, to work on that litigation on behalf of then-candidate George W. Bush. So, boy, if you want to talk about how relevant and how much the Supreme Court matters in people's lives, just open the phones and someone like David will call and say, what about Bush v. Gore?
You know, another few cases that come up, Ross from Newtown called, but he couldn't stay on the line. He wanted to ask about the ruling on Citizens United, something that again, not only is in effect every day in our lives, but as we head into this 2016 election, David Yeloff, maybe one of the most important rulings in the history of the court. What do we make of that? And is this the sort of issue that in a few years, once again, will in some way rise to the U.S. Supreme Court, because so many people in America feel that the outcome is now so profoundly broken in our political system.
Yeah, it is hard to imagine that we've seen the last of campaign finance and free speech cases before the court. And certainly future courts will take on aspects of it. I think what's so interesting when I speak to students and when I speak to groups, a lot of people have a lot of frustration with that particular opinion. And yet when you ask what the specifics are that they have a frustration, there's not a terrific layperson knowledge of what the opinion actually did. Because as you know, there was a lot of money in campaigns before that. It made some important changes, obviously. But I think what they remember a lot is the high drama, the president and his State of the Union address actually taking on the court, and Justice Alito sitting there disagreeing at least with his lips, well, with what the president was saying. And so there's a lot of frustration with that opinion. But, you know, whether it actually changed any outcomes in 2012, you know, President Obama was able to raise a lot of money in 2012 after that opinion. People do struggle with the details.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the current makeup of the court and what it might mean as some of the justices age perhaps into retirement, how that retirement might affect things like, well, this upcoming 2016 presidential election. We're talking today with David Yeloff from UConn, Renee Falco from Trinity, and Joan Biskupic from Reuters. We'll take some more of your calls as well at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's program, a new book examines one of the rarest of political categories, the Black Republican. Dr. Ben Carson is the only African-American in a crowded field for president. That disparity mirrors the nation as a whole, with race once again becoming one of the most important issues in our country. What is the present and future of Black Republicans in politics and also at the polls? You can join us on tomorrow's conversation here on Where We Live. Today, we're judging the Supreme Court. Renee Falco joins us from Trinity College. She's associate professor and director of the public policy and law program there. Joan Biskupic is editor-in-charge for legal affairs at Reuters News. She's the author of several books, including Breaking in the Rise of Sonia Sotomayor and The Politics of Justice. She's going to be appearing in Washington, Connecticut at an upcoming conversation about the court. We'll have more information on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. And also joining us by phone is David Yeloff. He's a professor and department head in the Department of Political Science at the University of Connecticut. I want to get to one of the really most pressing issues that gets back to politics, Joan, and it has to do with a potential retirement on the bench. Ruth Bader Ginsburg has for years been asked about when she may retire. And the fact is that at her age, it may very well likely come that she could retire during the term of the next president of the United States. And whoever the president is could very well then shift once again the balance of the court. I guess I'm wondering from your perspective what we make of that and what we know about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's intentions.
Well, I've talked with her several times about that because, as you and Rennie and David know, liberals have been calling for her to step down so that President Obama would be able to name her successor and not take a risk on the 2016 election. But she's not going anywhere fast. The woman is 82. She has survived two serious bouts with cancer. She works out regularly, gets herself checked regularly, and still is as sharp as anyone. So, and what she says to the folks who had been calling for her retirement before we got too close to the 2016 election, do you think that President Obama would be able to appoint someone who was more liberal than me in this atmosphere? So she has swatted away those detractors, and I think she's going to hang in there as much as she can. Justice John Paul Stevens, of course, did not retire until he was, you know, about 90, and she's using him as her model now. But you mentioned her, and you mentioned, and let me just make sure everybody realizes that we have two justices who are 79. In fact, is today the 23rd? Because I believe it's yes. Anthony Kennedy. Today is Kennedy's birthday. Justice Kennedy turned 79 today, and Justice Scalia already turned 79 this year. So we've got two other justices who are also getting close to when most Americans would be retiring. So the next president of the United States is going to have probably an opportunity to name one, if not two or three justices. And as we were talking earlier about how many cases come down to a single vote, just think of the power of that appointment and think of how much the next election is going to be able to shape the United States Supreme Court.
Right. And I guess I completely agree. And what I think about and when I talk to my students, having taught this for some time now, I sort of see the center on the court as having moved to the right, you know, not to the far right, but certainly to the right since when I started teaching this stuff. And so it seems to me that the next appointment will really be momentous and will have enormous consequences. Yet I feel like people often don't understand when they think about presidential politics, that this is one of the most important duties of a president. And I always, you know, try to get people to think more about that, the relationship between presidential elections and appointments to the court.
The center on the court, Rennie, may have moved right, but it seems as though the center of the American population has moved to the left on so many of the issues that we've
right.
talked about and
right.
so many of the issues that have been ruled on. So I guess I'm wondering how you view that tension moving forward, because indeed, maybe the court is moving in one direction, but a lot of America is moving in the other direction. Will America accept another justice who is either way more liberal than Ruth Bader Ginsburg or way more conservative than Antonin Scalia?
Well, I think you have to look at the court as a whole.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is common knowledge that a president's appointees are often the longest lasting legacy of that president. And so that's one of the I think it's one of the complicating factors here is that you've got people who were appointed by other presidents, and you've got to deal with the entire court. And although one appointment certainly changes it, you still have those other appointments on there from other presidents.
David, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, it is so interesting and impossible to predict. I remember in the late 70s, a lot of people were pressing for William Brennan to retire from the court while Jimmy Carter was still president. And, you know, obviously he didn't. He ended up leaving during George H.W. Bush's term and being replaced by a more conservative justice, at least they thought it was going to be. And, you know, you would have lost 12 or 13 years of William Brennan's jurisprudence. So, you know, the justices, they walk by their own, they walk as they will, and it's very difficult to predict. I don't think anybody would have predicted that George W. Bush would go an entire term without having the chance to name a justice, or that Bill Clinton, after naming two right away, ended up getting no more justices to appoint for the rest of his two terms.
David, I'd like you to weigh in on one issue that we haven't gotten to yet that is, I think, important. We got a tweet from Peter who says, judges are not politicians. These judges have no accountability, as they don't have to run for re-election. We hear Ted Cruz talking about periodic judicial elections, and according to a recent Reuters poll, a majority of Americans would support imposing term limits for Supreme Court justices. David, you know, if America thinks maybe we shouldn't have someone who serves for life, maybe a president 20 or 30 years ago shouldn't get to have such outsized influence, maybe someone shouldn't be serving in their 90s. I mean, what do you say to that?
You know, it's tough. There are two different aspects of that question because it is fascinating. I mean, I think one is the simple issue of fairness. If it really comes down to issues of health that can be very unexpected, or also the notion that certain justices might try to retire at a certain time strategically so that they can affect the successor. I think there is a sense of inequity or a sense of queasiness there that if you had very specific, let's say, 14-year or whatever terms that justices would have and people left in a more routine or systematic way, it would at least ensure that presidents were getting the same, relatively, the same number. And I think that is something that it continues to gain a lot of traction or interest among many groups. But I think that once an actual justice does retire and you get into the whole question of who to replace him or her, I do think that there's a lot of focus on what the person has done in his or her own past judicial opinions in the case of a judge or what they've done when they were Harvard Law School dean in the case of Elena Kagan. And all these questions of politics versus law kind of disappear for a second with just trying to figure out what this justice will do and whether what this justice will do is predictable.
Joan, I'd like you to weigh in on that quickly if you could.
Just that it's we'd have to amend the Constitution, so it's sort of out of the question for the near future. But the other thing is these justices who have served for 2 and 3 decades have a very varied tenure. Justice John Paul Stevens was much different when he retired in 2010 than he was in 1975. Very different ideological role on the court and leadership role. And the same with Justice Ginsburg, who's now our senior liberal there and assigns all the opinions for that side when the liberals are together. And she's really making her mark in a way that might not have been predicted in the 90s.
We have just a few minutes left, and Joan, I want to get to something else that doesn't have to do with the justices in the court. It's about the lawyers who argue in front of the court. Reuters investigated why it is that Supreme Court cases are so often argued by this very tight circle of lawyers. You were involved in that investigation. At a top line here, what did you learn?
We went back and looked through 17,000 petitions to the court. And just so your listeners know, these are the filings that actually launch a case where someone who's lost in the lower court comes forward and says, please hear my case. The justices get literally tens of thousands of these, and they only take about 70 cases each term. And we decided to look at the lawyers who had the most significant – who were appearing more before the justices and had remarkable success even getting the justices to take up their cases. And we found that less than 1% of the lawyers who were filing were controlling almost half of the docket, and that there were certain consistent patterns among those lawyers. Many of them had clerked for justices. Many of them had worked in the U.S. Solicitor General's office. That's the top government office appearing before the court. They came from the traditional Ivy League schools and in most cases represented corporate America. So we thought it was important for readers and frankly for the justices themselves to point out that there was this deep pattern there. And the justices said to a person, we like it this way. We want that professional expertise. And we think that if there are important cases coming up from lawyers who come from, you know, out in the hinterlands, we will recognize their case as important.
there's an awful lot to be troubled by there. But maybe the most troubling thing is this idea that we like it that way. We like these, I'll put in air quotes now, professional attorneys arguing in front of them. There's something that feels inordinately creepy about that, Joan, and I guess I'm wondering how concerned we should be.
Well, I do think that people should wonder about it because it does seem lopsided, and the justices might not even recognize how much they've been tilting to that end. And I interviewed, when I did those stories, interviewed the liberals first, thinking that they would object, that they would say, because I said, would someone like a Ruth Bader Ginsburg be able to break in these days? And because that's how she made her name, arguing before the justices way back when. And they didn't seem as concerned, and they felt like, sure, more women are appearing before the court. But I have to say, of that field that we narrowed on, the 66 lawyers, you could count on one hand the number of people of color, and I think there were only 8 women among them.
Can I jump in
please,
a second?
Please do, yes.
I just thought it was interesting. You know, the kind of premise here is that these individuals who are what Mark Gallanter, the famous political scientist, called repeat players, that they come back over and over. And, of course, John Roberts, most famously among them, and ended up on the court itself. How much of a difference they really do end up making in whether it's the cert petition stage, the court deciding to grant the case, or in actually deciding whether the case should be reversed or affirmed? I always remember that it was Donald Verrilli, the Solicitor General, a repeat player by any definition, who was, you know, really chastised, and a lot of people complained with how he handled the first Obamacare case several years ago, and of course the government ended up winning. So it is a question of whether these repeat players are providing the justices with the venue, they're providing the justices with the forum for them to review the opinions, but in the end, whether the justices are really going to change their opinion based on the fact that an individual in front of them has been in front of them so many other times, that's a different ball of wax to unpack.
Rennie, we just have about 30 seconds, but
yeah,
I'd love to hear you on
this. What I was going to say, I thought that the series was absolutely terrific. I assign it. And I thought one of the most interesting findings was how business interests predominated. And I really thought that was incredibly interesting and important.
But how business interests predominated, but also, I think, as Joan points out, that you end up with a very small group of say, African-Americans or very small group of women who are in front of the court. And that does have long-term implications if indeed it matters as we heard earlier from Jeff Toobin, that there are three women who sit on the Supreme Court for both practical, realistic, and also symbolic reasons. It's probably practical, symbolic, and important that only a handful of women and minorities get to argue in front of the court as well. I want to thank Rennie Falco from Trinity College, the Associate Professor and Director of the Public Policy and Law Program. Thank you so much, Rennie. Great to see
Happy
you.
Happy to be.
Thanks also to Joan Biskupic, who is Editor-in-Charge for Legal Affairs at Reuters News. She's going to be involved in this conversation. Verdict on the Nine, How to Judge the Supreme Court in Washington, Connecticut on August 9th. Thank you so much, Joan.
Thank you, John.
And thank you also to David Yeloff, professor and department head in the Department of Political Science at UConn. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.